my God, the bomb has just dropped. And everybody climbed right on top, screaming, what a wonderful country.
This is Sabrina Artel with Talk Universe Seeking Justice. What chain of events did September 11th unwind? We'll spend an hour in conversation with people who have much to say about how we've been politically affected and the kind of turn the country has taken over the last year. Author Salar Abdo reads excerpts from a piece he wrote for the BBC.
Some months after September 11th, I found myself inside an interrogation room in New York City, faced with a U.S. special agent flanked by two burly guards. The matter in hand, passport fraud and illegal entry into the United States. I sat in the cramped, brightly lit room with its obvious and ominous one-way mirror, not as one of the accused, rather, I was translating for friends from Iran, a young woman and her mother. Yet even before this episode occurred, I knew that we had entered a new age, one that I would call the age of terrorcrats. Already by the end of September 2001, one could see that this shift had begun. Counterterrorism was all the rage, becoming the fastest ticket to political promotion, election, re-election, and 15 minutes of media fame. It is not just moral reservations that drive me to criticize certain policies of the country, of which I am now unconditionally and wholeheartedly a citizen. We don't just live in a tough neighborhood after all, but in a very tough world. So if the counterterrorism game needs to be played, how much better it would be if it were played with depth and finesse rather than thoughtless declarations that only alienate foreign nations, while allowing American decision-makers to delude themselves into thinking progress is being made. Of all the steps taken since 9/11, for example, the one that really stuck in the craw of those who had been working, often successfully, toward democratic change in Iran was President Bush's axis of evil speech. The hardliners in Iran were beside themselves with joy on hearing their country damned by his phrase, because in one stroke, my president had created a situation where an Iranian calling for a dialogue with the United States, as many had been doing, would be accused of treason by the fundamentalists. Fundamentalism essentially splits the world into good and evil, and woe unto those who live on the wrong side of the fence. No one has suffered the consequences of Islamic fundamentalism more than Muslims themselves. And many of us who were born in the Middle East but chose to leave did so because we value the traditions of Western humanism, pluralism, rule of law, and the separation of church and state. Therefore, to America, I say, don't cut us out. Don't draw the curtain on us. Help us Muslims both within and beyond America so we can help you. In the long run, the peddlers of radical Islam can only be neutralized by Muslims themselves. Blocking immigration or pressuring Muslim citizens living amongst us will only alienate the very people who should be at the vanguard of the struggle against intolerance and religious narrow-mindedness. And yet, a year after September 11th, I still feel jittery when I have to sign for a package delivered to my door. Why did the delivery man ask me to spell my name? Was that a certain look he gave me when I pronounced my distinctly Middle Eastern last name to him? Am I being paranoid? Maybe, but maybe not. Then what am I to think about the recently proposed TIPS program, the so-called Terrorism Information and Prevention System, where Americans working for utility and postal delivery services will be asked to report anything suspicious on their routes? What exactly would qualify as suspicious to the cable man who has come to fix my TV reception? Would my name be enough, or the fact that on my shelves I have books on terrorism and espionage because that just happens to be something I write about? I do not know. What I do know is that at the end of that day in the company of the government agents and the two Iranian women under interrogation, I could not help but ask exactly why the ladies' passports were being taken from them, even though they were entirely legitimate documents issued by the consular office of a European Union nation. Looking away, The special agent told me that it was because the passports had not been obtained through normal procedures. Strictly speaking, he was right. They hadn't. But nor had the passports of thousands of innocent people who would have surely expired in Hitler's Europe had not some consular officer decided to be good to them. Not feeling like laboring the point, I remained quiet that day. Then a week later, my friends finally phoned from back in Tehran. The younger woman, who had been one of several thousand people in Iran who had braved the beatings of government thugs to go out on the street and hold a candlelight vigil for the victims of September 11th, told me something. She told me that if there were to be another attack on America, she would not make such an effort again. "No," she said, "I will not shed another tear for America."
We've been listening to author Salar Abdo, the Poet Game, read a piece for the BBC reflecting upon the last year. Salar Abdo is a Persian-American who fled the Islamic Revolution with his family. He teaches English at the City University of New York. Salar, your novel came out before September 11th, but both because of the subject of your novel, terrorists operating in New York City, and your ethnic background, you have been asked often to respond since the attacks.
Yes, I have.
Has your response to September 11th changed over the last year?
In the past year, in the beginning of it, so much of it for me was about the subject of terrorism and how terrorism had snowballed into what it has become today. Later on, as the so-called war against terror got into full swing and I saw different situations developing both in the United States vis-a-vis Middle Eastern Americans and also outside of the United States, my views, yes, there was an evolution, and I often found myself at odds with some of the policies that are being implemented. In the long run, it's going to be damaging for the United States, as damaging as it was throughout the last decade, two decades in nurturing the Taliban as they did and other ultra-fundamentalist factions in Afghanistan, and also their relationships with oil-producing nations like Saudi Arabia. I think in this war on terrorism, the U.S. government is repeating some mistakes that it has made in the past, and it's going to come back to haunt it as it did recently. And a lot of other people I know who came back from different parts of the world during the summer echoed the same thing, that when you go around the world, there really is deep resentment and often out-and-out hostility towards the United States. And, the reasons for it are, everybody has their own reasons. And the Mexican corn farmer who can't sell his corn for a living wage because the American, through NAFTA, is forcing Mexico to not subsidize its farmers while it's subsidizing its own American farmers. He has his own reason for hating America. And, the Indonesian guy who went and shot a couple of Americans at that gold mine has his reasons for hating America. And, the Uzbek guy, a child whose father is in jail for having a beard, and meanwhile there's American military attaches all over the country. He has his own reasons for hating America. And the European diplomat who sees, when he sees America, flaunt, disregard the Kyoto Protocol or the World Court, he has his reasons. So, when you go around the world, you see that there are a variety of reasons, but they're there. And often get asked, why do people hate Americans so much? Well, these are the reasons. Sometimes they're justified, sometimes they're not.
How does this make you feel as an American and also as a Persian American?
Because I am an American citizen, but I wasn't born here, so I don't really know what I am. And in the last year, I've questioned that more and more because I've been in situations where, you know, you overhear people talking about Middle Easterners and such in such ways that you really wonder whether you belong here. Or, and you certainly, someone like me knows for sure he doesn't belong to the Middle East because I left at such a young age. So it just makes me very ambivalent towards the world I live in.
So it is a difficult time.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're a sentient human being, you cannot help but think about these things.
That was writer Salar Abdo. He was reached from his home in New York City. Next, I'll be speaking with Andrew Rice, who is a member and organizer for September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows and Others. His brother David was killed at the World Trade Center on September 11th. Could you tell us about your involvement in Peaceful Tomorrows?
When David was killed, he worked in the World Trade Center on the South Tower for a firm called Sandler O'Neill. And when he was killed and we all got together, my family, and had his funeral and were spending time together and in the early stages of grieving, we, as a small and tight family, talked together about the importance of not letting this turn us towards bitterness and resentment. And it started off a very personal journey in that sense. It was just sort of me and reflecting and how to deal with my anger at David being murdered. It was not an accident. He didn't die in a car wreck. You know, he was purposefully murdered by people. So it was hard at the beginning, but part of what drew me to Peaceful Tomorrows was two things. It was David's own approach to life and his own sense of reconciliation. He was actually quite a remarkable person in that sense, his own faith. And then my own, the things that I had studied in school. I have a master's in theology, and I sort of spent a good number of years studying these things, the role of religion and reconciling and not demonizing people who commit evil acts against you, all these sort of things. And all of a sudden, I was stuck in this position where I had to try to hold on to these beliefs when it really mattered, when I was confronted with these problems firsthand. It wasn't an intellectual process anymore. It was a personal process. And so I luckily found out about Peaceful Tomorrows, which was started by a number of relatives from different parts of the country who had lost loved ones on September 11th, whether it be at the Pentagon or New York or in Pennsylvania, and all being concerned with the rhetoric in the country, with our actions by going to war as a solution to the war to our problem with terrorism. Yeah, and explicitly political foreign policy type of issues. I mean, it's a combination of sort of all across the spectrum of how do we deal with it personally, psychologically, spiritually, what are the ways in which that our elected officials deal with it militarily or politically, diplomatically. I would say that most all of us are anti-war. I mean, there are some of us like myself who I do believe somewhat in the idea of like a just war theory, in the sense that if we're being attacked by someone, which is not the case with Afghanistan, there are some very limited cases where you need to defend yourself. So I'm not a 100% absolute pacifist in that sense, but going to a war with Afghanistan and dropping bombs to bring these perpetrators of al-Qaeda to justice for a crime against humanity is not what we think is a sound course of action at all. We all are in unison on believing that there should have been a UN type of force, a police type force, which can easily be assembled through NATO or otherwise, to try to apprehend terror cells around the world and being brought to the International Criminal Court, rather than dropping bombs that hit villages and kill other innocent people just like my brother.
How do you feel about the way the U.S. government and the media have used your brother's death and the others who were killed on September 11th?
Well, I think that probably was the central rallying cry for most of us. Some members of the group before I got involved did a march, a walk from Washington to New York, and holding signs that said, you know, our grief is not a cry for war. When Bush gave his speech at the National Cathedral, which I think was a day or two after the 11th last year, it became very clear to those of us who had lost family members that he was going to utilize the pain and the tragedy of what happened as a justification. There needed to be a long, arduous, and sort of inner searching type of debate about what should be done. Varying degrees of opinion across the political and intellectual and religious landscape of America should have been able to input how to respond to this huge event, I mean, one of the biggest events in American history. And that's not what happened.
So you have been ignored, would you say, then?
Well, I think that we have in many ways. I think in very, very explicit ways we've been ignored because we sent our group sent a Valentine card to President Bush on Valentine's Day asking him to consider initiating legislation or signing on to legislation when it came to him to create a Afghan victims fund,
mm-hmm.
For innocent people killed in the war in Afghanistan who were just like our family members. You know, they rushed through a bill that is given, you know, family members of 9/11 millions of dollars to save the airlines. And there's an Afghani-American woman who went down and volunteered at Ground Zero and a New Yorker and went to Afghanistan to visit her family because she was concerned about them a month or two later when the bombing had started. And she actually found out that she lost 19 members of her extended family. So there's this valuation that's gone on in American life where someone who's collateral damage, quote-unquote, in Afghanistan, his life is less important. It's permissible to kill them to where our loved ones, there's more of a value, supposedly, on my brother and these other people who were killed in America. And as far as we are concerned, all deaths to violence are equal.
How has your life changed with the murder of your brother, David?
Well, I think in one sense, like I said before, it's forced me to really make a decision and to commit myself to ideals that I held dear to my heart when it was easy. I thought it's time for me to really decide how I want to live my life in memory of him, to make the most out of every day. So I grew up in Oklahoma. A good deal of my family is still there, so I decided to come to Texas to work with a progressive group that counters religious extremism down here. So I've been working down here and coordinated a project that we just launched about 3 weeks ago, the Fundamentalism Education Project. We work with religious communities of different sorts across Texas, educating people about how fundamentalist religion is common among the different faith traditions. There's all this focus on Islam and Islamic fundamentalists, but we have a tremendous amount of problem with Christian fundamentalists in this country as well as Jewish fundamentalists in Israel. And so this is this has been meaningful for me to work on this. It sort of brings a bit of redemption to what is otherwise, and there's no redeeming value to September 11th. I mean,
right.
That day in and of itself is just a dark day. So I'm trying to bring some sort of redemption to David being taken from us.
Yes.
It helps a bit to deal with it psychologically.
I've been speaking with Andrew Rice from Families for Peaceful Tomorrows and others. He was reached from his home in Houston. I'm speaking with Martha Cameron from Justice for Detainees. They have been demonstrating against the secret roundups of immigrants in the name of national security. Could you tell us about Justice for Detainees?
Well, we began as an ad hoc group to demonstrate in front of the Metropolitan Detention Center, which is a maximum security federal prison in Brooklyn that most of us didn't even know existed. And we started demonstrating after we learned that there were approximately 50 people who were being held there as part of the government's secret roundup after September 11th. The government rounded up about 1,200 people in the first 2 months after September. And
how many people would you say are being detained at this point?
At this point, we really have no clear idea. There have been ongoing arrests every single week in all the immigrant communities, the Arab South Asian communities.
Your group, Justice for Detainees, is making the public aware of this assault on our civil liberties by holding demonstrations?
We've been holding demonstrations for many months now, and we plan to continue to hold them until we find out the names of the people who have been arrested. This is the big issue. The government has refused to reveal the list of names of the people they've arrested. They've refused to list locations. They've refused to list the charges against them. The government is carrying out mass deportations now. It's had two mass deportations of Pakistanis that we know of. There was a mass deportation of Filipinos and Cambodians recently. There was another roundup of Koreans last week. They've been put into detention. And what's happening now is what started out as an attack on Arab and South Asian immigrants, mostly for really very minor visa violations. None of these people have been connected to terrorism after months and months and months of interrogation and imprisonment. Now the roundups are spreading to nationals of other countries.
Over the last year, with the USA Patriot Act and the TIPS program, there have been many people hauled out of their houses with no just cause.
Absolutely. And done in a way that is designed not only to terrify them, but to terrify the whole immigrant community.
Ihab El-Megrabi has been in prison for almost 1 year. International law recognizes solitary confinement as cruel and unusual punishment.
You're put into a cell, a 5x8 cell. The lights are on 24 hours a day. The windows are painted white. You're extremely restricted in what you can read. You get no radio or television or newspapers. You get what Ihab has been allowed is one 15-minute telephone call a month.
I understand that many of you are very concerned about him. He seems to have disappeared.
He seems to have disappeared. We have not heard from him in almost 2 weeks. I've been in regular correspondence with him. I have not heard from him. A number of civil liberties organizations are looking into his case, trying to get access.
What is happening with these immigrants has a huge impact on the entire population of the United States.
Yeah, what a lot of people don't realize is that what is being done to the immigrant population can also be done to us. It was under the anti-terrorism and effective death penalty law that the government was able to begin its prosecution of a U.S. citizen, John Walker Lind. By the way, this is a particular law that was declared unconstitutional on its face. That's a direct quote from a U.S. district judge when Walker was being prosecuted. It's a law that allows for the use of secret hearings, of hearsay evidence. You cannot face your accuser. And it was kind of a herald for the USA Patriot Act, which was passed by Congress, largely unread by members of Congress since they hadn't come back from the printer. This mammoth law that gives tremendous power to the executive branch of the government. And this is, in fact, what's happening right now, is more and more laws are being passed where power is being concentrated in the hands of the executive, and we're seeing a complete breakdown in the separation of powers. This is a very dangerous situation. Congress seems to have no backbone at the moment, with a handful of exceptions. John Conyers stands out. Barbara Lee stands out. This is a very frightening time for American democracy.
It is. That was Martha Cameron from Justice for Detainees. She was reached in New York. I'm speaking with lawyer Stanley Cohen. He has represented Musa Abu Marzouk, head of the political wing of Hamas. He has a lawsuit against Israel and the U.S. government. He's defended the IRA. In the National Journal, Henry Mark Holzer labels Stanley Cohen a member of today's fifth column. Quote, any group of people who give aid and support to the enemy from within their own country, end quote. It can also be said Stanley Cohen gives defense to those whose legal voice has been silenced. What's your response to the last year?
I share with the outrage and the pain and suffering of so many people who lost their lives in this horrible attack, just as I do share with the pain and suffering of hundreds and tens of hundreds of thousands and millions of people throughout the world who have also lost their lives in horrible attacks, but attacks at the hands of the United States or friends of the United States or Israel. They all must stop. More pointedly, with response to your question, I think perhaps more than anything else, well, not more than anything else, but over and above the pain that I share with others, here we are a year later, and it seems to me that we have missed in our race for revenge and to exact retribution and punishment a wonderful opportunity over the last year, perhaps to sit, to reflect, contemplate, and to do something about the issues which served as a tripwire which brought us September 11th, and which I think tragically will continue to bring other September 11s, not just to North Americans, not just to U.S. citizens, but to people throughout the world.
Many Americans don't understand why the U.S. is so hated as a country, as a body politic.
We have armed persons and governments that have been repressive and created crimes and war crimes and genocide against its own people. We have funded terrorist rogue states. We have exacted tremendous pain and suffering on innocents and civilians throughout the world and in Latin America. We have supported regimes that have violated international law in their names, in our names. We have refused to sign on to treaties that deal with the issues of environmental safety, that deal with international prohibitions against torture, that establish neutral independent war tribunals. We are, after all, the country that brought, going back years ago, the only country to ever use nuclear weapons. We have used saturation bombings repeatedly for decades. So as an entity, our military and our leadership for years, particularly in Asia, in the Middle East, and in Latin America, has just repeatedly been on the wrong side. And always we do what we say for the right reasons. And it just has, unfortunately, developed a tremendous anti-American backlash. But yet, on the other hand, throughout my travels, I always hear wonderful things about American people, about you, about me, about citizens. So many folks who, at the same time that they register outrage and resistance to U.S. government and military and police policies overseas, say, but, you know, my beef isn't with the American people. They're good people. But there is this line drawn when it comes to the extraordinary power and force that our so-called leadership has used, just regardless of the sentiment, the needs, and the big picture overseas for decades.
Stanley, what has changed for you in this time of both legislative changes and overt xenophobia?
Prior to September 11th, I did not have the fear that I do now about the world scene. Obviously, I was very disturbed about what we were doing and what Israel was doing and what other allies were doing overseas, that I really thought there were just a host of human rights and international law issues that really disturbed me. But I just was not driven or consumed with this terrible fear that things are getting worse and getting worse in a way. This is very much an ugly time and an ugly place, but there's no difference. The difference is essentially we're more overt now. For more than a decade, we have literally been attacking in this country Muslims for a host of reasons. There have been grand jury investigations and secret evidence and deportations and blacklistings and harassment, infiltration of mosques, illegal surveillance. So that's been going on for a decade. We are now in a period where the government is doing it publicly and openly and with the support of a tremendous number of American citizens. So that's different. What's also different is the willingness of so many citizens to just defer blindly to a political agenda, and in so doing to sacrifice fundamental bedrock constitutional protections and notions going back since the founding of this country. That's pretty alarming and frightening. This is so much worse in so many ways than the McCarthyism of the 50s and the Karamazov jailings of the 40s and the COINTELPRO harassment of the 60s and 70s, because this is being done openly and candidly and with the support of a large amount of Americans who are just petrified and are blindly, unfortunately, deferring to people like Bush and Ashcroft and folks who are just either way in over their heads or have a very dangerous conservative ideological program that they've been trying to force down us for decades unsuccessfully, but now we're doing it every day in every aspect of our lives.
Do you think that the attacks on September 11th and the media saturation surrounding it have become a veil for other political agendas?
Oh, absolutely. I think we've seen for years there's been the think tanks on the far right in this country, some of them so-called Christian right, many of them holdovers of other administrations that were on the outs. You could always count on them for coming in and speaking, preaching to the converted, so to say. These were folks that really did not have much input, much influence, or much sway in the government. today we see these private institutions have insinuated themselves into the Pentagon, the Defense Department, the military apparatus, and into the hearts and minds of so many U.S. citizens because they're speaking on TV and radio as if they represent a rational mainstream political ideology. They are influencing our policy at home. They are influencing our policy abroad. And it's not a new policy that's tailored to meet the problems of September 11th. It is a continuation of that dangerous, disruptive, militaristic policy that they've been preaching and trying to accomplish for decades, and fortunately, largely unsuccessfully. That's changed.
What's your definition of terrorism?
There's a fine line between terrorist and freedom fighter, between terrorist and hero, and it's who wins. If you take a look at whether it's our own country, where we built the land on the backs of slaughtering, killing hundreds of thousands of Indians. That's certainly terrorism, but yet we extol the value of those great freedom fighters that settled the West and made our country. Israel is the direct result of terrorism against Palestinians in the 40s and the 50s, hotels blown up, the King David Hotel, assassinations, villages burned to the ground, rapes used to send political messages. Those terrorists, quote-unquote, became heroes, freedom fighters, because they won. Nelson Mandela, the beloved, wonderful, sainted leader of so much and so many minds in this world today, 25 years in jail, and I certainly don't support a day in jail for what it's alleged he did, or in fact what he did do, keep in mind was jailed because he was part of a movement which was responsible for a series of bombings and attacks in terms of South Africa. He was at one time considered and called a terrorist and now is a hero. So the description, the labeling process which the U.S. government uses now is nothing different than the one that the West has used historically, where it's used interchangeably. If you're with us, you're a freedom fighter. If you've won, you're a hero. If you're against us or you're fighting, you're a terrorist.
Tell us about the lawsuit against Israel, American munitions manufacturers, some U.S. Christian and Jewish groups, and George Bush.
We are representing a large class, or what will soon be a large class, of Palestinian Americans, U.S. citizens, who have been killed, who have been wounded, who have been tortured, whose homes and businesses have been destroyed, whose land has been stolen for the establishment of so-called settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. And the suit essentially says, we're part of the war on terrorism. George Bush has said repeatedly that wherever U.S. citizens are killed or injured or their property damaged, the United States will reach out and bring to justice the people who have done it, will bring justice to them. It's interesting that this holds true for everyone but Palestinian Americans. You know, you keep in mind, these are U.S. citizens. We are representing in a U.S. court under U.S. law. So there's tremendous precedent here. It's been my experience that the Middle East in particular is just filled with very warm and caring and supportive and community-minded, wonderful people. Not the picture that the United States would like to paint that says, if you're with us, you're a good Muslim, and if you're not, you're a bad Muslim.
When certain militant Jewish organizations criticize you and call you a traitor and they say, but how could he? He's a Jew. And your response has been, how could I not? I am a Jew.
The Judaism of my parents and grandparents and great-grandparents is not the Judaism of Ariel Sharon or the IDF or Zionism. Our Judaism is the Judaism that for the millennium has stood shoulder to shoulder with the disaffected, with the oppressed, with the voiceless and the powerless. It is my brand, our brand of Judaism, that says, no. We will not sit back idly while persons are singled out because of their race or creed or religion or politics, jailed, tortured, killed. No, my brand, our brand of Judaism, and I am by no means alone here, there are thousands of Jews all over the world becoming increasingly involved in the issue of Palestine. We say not in our name. Israel and so many American Jews tragically keep resurrecting the Holocaust. It was a horrible situation. It's not unique. Many folks have suffered tremendous losses because of race and religion throughout history. The lesson they failed to learn about the Holocaust was the tragedy was not just in the very death and pain and destruction which was meted out, but the tragedy is that the world was largely silent. And in the Judaism that is near and dear to my history and my tradition and my experience is one that says, no, no, not in my name. I will not be, I won't go silently into the night. I have certain skills and beliefs and commitments, and I will use them in a variety of ways. And with regard to Palestinians, I'll use them to represent and to fight for my cousins, because we are cousins and we're one family. I just am so outraged that there are Jews in Israel or elsewhere who just believe that anything and everything that Israel does to millions of Palestinians is okay. And it's that type of apologist, the willingness to accept, to hold Israel at a level different than the rest of the world, that just burns a hole in my heart, that just literally causes tremendous suffering for me as a Jew and as someone who certainly lost family in World War II and lost a cousin in a bombing in Israel.
Hmm.
It's an outrage that Jews would be doing this to other people.
What does one say in response to people's expression of deep fear and of being attacked?
Look, it's a difficult world and there are difficult issues, but there is a direct nexus, a direct relationship between certain U.S. policies in the Middle East and overseas and the issues that we should be fearful of. There are certain things that if the U.S. became actively involved in a progressive and a supportive and a good way, that would immediately remove tripwires in the Middle East. One is we have to stop this blind, myopic, complete fixation and support of Israel. We have to, you know, we keep talking about how we want to find a solution and broker a solution, but you can't find or broker a solution if you're a partisan. We try to dictate that Palestinian people should have certain systems of governments and elected leaderships, and if they don't, we can't support them. That's not consistent with notions of democracy. At the same time, some of our closest allies in the Middle East don't have democratic regimes or constitutions because of the U.S. embargo. You've got situations where the United States has blindly supported totalitarian regimes in the Middle East besides Israel, including Egypt. And to some extent, Jordan. We have used folks in the Gulf as puppets to carry out our policy. Just in the context of the Middle East, these are issues which can be rectified, which can be addressed, which can be reversed, and if so, would remove a tremendous amount of anger, a tremendous amount of hostility, and might earn friends there. So, yes, there are people that are afraid of an attack. They are fearful of retaliation. My response is, it doesn't matter how many gas masks you get. It doesn't matter how many anthrax injections or smallpox inoculations you want to get. It doesn't matter how many cops we put on our streets or people we put in our jails. Unless we begin to change our policies, unless we begin to examine, to address, and to rectify wrongs that we have carried out throughout the world, there are going to be problems.
It's become obvious over the last year we can't ignore these problems.
September 11th, as I said, was a turning point in many ways. But most of all, it really should have served as a wake-up call, not just because we've got to go bomb and kill and say never again, but because we really need to take a look at who we are as a country and who we are as people and what it is we are willing to do or not do with regard to a world that is growing increasingly younger and browner, while we are growing increasingly older, and from a political standpoint, whiter.
I've been speaking with Stanley Cohen, attorney, from his office in New York City. Rabab Abdulhadi is a professor of sociology and gender and sexuality at New York University. She has spoken and written quite a bit about being a Palestinian woman. Her essay, Where is Home? Fragmented Lives, Border Crossings, and the Politics of Exile, deals with the question of identity and one's home. As a Palestinian American, as a woman who is culturally Muslim,
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you could address for us what this last year has been and what the issues are you're dealing with.
Yeah, it's been actually quite tough. Before 9/11, many of us born Muslim, raised Muslim, identified as Muslim, whether we want it or not, were completely invisible. And this presented a problem because there was no recognition of where we're coming from. There is no recognition of our feast. There is no recognition of our food. There is always a question if you say, I don't eat pork. People immediately assume you're Jewish. Very few people would assume that you may be a Muslim and you don't eat pork and so on. And so we were always wishing for some kind of visibility, for some kind of recognition of our ethnicity, where we're coming from, parts of us. The problem is with 9/11, we became very visible as enemy, public enemy number one. And that presented a serious problem. So it presented a serious problem in terms of safety, security of the body, of the person, of the ideas, and so on. But it also presented issues about how you can present yourself, how you can interact with the public sphere, with the public around you. How do you even define yourself? No matter what you do, you're sort of like damned if you do, damned if you don't.
To quote from your paper, you say passing is a survival strategy.
Right.
And that is to pass as a quote-unquote real American.
In terms of the dominant discourses in the United States, the dominant ideas, what people, when people think of what is an American, whether you are here in this country or whether you are abroad overseas, people think usually of the white, you know, middle class, blonde, blue-eyed person. Although this country is very multicultural, multi-ethnic, multinational, so there is this kind of like question of what is it that you look like and what is it that you pass as. And for me, because I do not veil and I look like your regular, you know, middle class professor. Professional person who's walking down the street, it's always an issue. So whenever I would go, for instance, to NYU to ask for an ID or something, it's always the first impulse from people who interact with me is in recognition, welcome, and so on. I'm just one of you. And then when my name comes up, Abdul Hadi, Abdul, it becomes immediately an issue. And you can see the smile maybe fading away from people's faces or something of the sort. And it really presents a problem.
You write that besides the fear of our loved ones, whom we could not locate for several hours on that infamous day, we no longer feel safe.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I was just, I remember on 9/11, I was coming home and I shared the taxi with four, you know, white businessmen coming home. And I asked the taxi driver to drop me away from home and I walked a block. And I didn't want people to know where I was living. I didn't want people to sort of recognize my accent because I have a slight accent. And somebody is bound to ask me where you're from, where did you come from? And I can't just say I'm from New York because I'm not only from New York. I'm also from other places. And then I was coming home and I kept thinking, God, do people know I live here? Do people know this is my address? And I kept thinking because in the 80s there was a bomb placed at the door of the director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Los Angeles, and he pipe bombed. He was killed. And so I kept thinking of all of these things, you know, thank God nothing happened, but there is the potential. So you're always feeling afraid of being caught at the wrong place at the wrong time. So the question of ethnic profiling, racial profiling, is a very serious issue. There is the potential always of being attacked. Whether you are or not, it's always there. You're very conscious of it. And it is something that, to tell you the truth, frankly, before 9/11, I was not as conscious of it. I was always conscious of the fact that maybe we do not fit in whatever is supposed to be the dominant American thing. But who does? Nobody does. But now there is sort of like singling singling people of ethnicity like mine, of background, of cultural, of religion like mine, and so on.
And there are such stereotypes also of a Muslim woman.
Yeah, and this is the thing, is like one of the issues for me is that I don't wear a hijab. But how is it for a woman who does? What does that mean? I mean, you know, I'm going through all these introspective issues and self-reflexivity and wondering about how do I fit and so on. But I can pass if I want to. I can pass if I want to, if I need to survive. But if you are wearing your markings on your body around, and I remember a couple of Jewish friends of mine have written a piece a while ago about Boyarin and Boyarin, about during Nazism, how Jewish men could not hide who they were if they undressed them. You're wearing your markings on your body, and now they choose whether they want to wear a yarmulke or not. And this is sort of, if you choose not to wear it, it means you're actually making a decision not to declare in public who you are in order for you to protect the safety of your body. And this is the same thing for Muslim women, because a lot of them, I remember immediately after 9/11, they started wearing hats instead of the hijab. They started like doing all sorts of ways in order to kind of like abide by their religious principles and so on, but at the same time not betray who they are. And it's a very, very serious issue to actually think of betraying who you are rather than thriving and celebrating who you are in this age of multiculturalism, you know.
And when you no longer feel safe, you become fragmented in mm-hmm. your attempt to survive within the dominant culture.
Definitely. And you never feel, I mean, the thing is that you never feel at home. There is a sense of safety and security at home. When you have problems and so on, you say, I want to go home. You go to your house, you lock the door, even if it's a small apartment, even if it's a card box. You go and you have sort of like this space in which you feel really safe and secure, and you can't even feel safe and secure there because there is no home.
You write in the section, Exile and Exclusion, who goes home and who is left behind. You were recently on the West Bank.
We used to say as Palestinians that one of the most traumatic experiences for us was to cross borders, to go to airports, because the minute you get to the airport, and anybody who asks you where you're from, the impulse is to always say Palestinian. You know, I'm from Palestine. And then you realize that either it is not recognized. If somebody is hostile, they say no such country. Of course, there is no such country on the map yet. And or if it is somebody who says, what does this mean? You know, where are you really? What's your passport from? And so on. So you are already somebody you're not. And then at the same time, it's all the trauma of going through the border crossing. In my particular case, I'm a U.S. citizen, so I have a U.S. passport. Actually, I don't even have a Palestinian passport, and I was accompanying my elderly parents from London to Jordan, Jordan to across the bridge to Nablus. Nablus today is 80 days under curfew, continuous 24-hour curfew. It was a nightmare. We made a trip that takes for like 2-3 hours. It took us 11 hours. We were searched so many times. We were rudely treated. Everything was humiliating from beginning to end. So this is something that if you want to cross the borders, not only are you not free in your own home, in your own surroundings and so on, but wherever you go, there is always traumatic experiences. And nobody should have to go through that.
Complete displacement as well. And in your writings, you connect your life in New York City with your life when you're visiting there and your family's life. And
right.
Again, this idea of your own identity and an erasure of home.
Well, I think this is the whole essence of, you know, transnational lives. And I think, I mean, now in academia, this becomes an idea that people are picking up on and talking about it and so on. But it's not a new experience. Maybe it's a new experience for studying, for academic studies. But it is something that people who migrate, who are exiled, who are displaced, have had to deal with for a very, very long time. And it is that you do not feel comfortable answering the question, where is your home exactly? Because you feel at home in different places, in different ways. So why do you have to choose? But when whatever is home for you, whether it is here in the United States or over there, abroad for me, Palestine, for instance, wherever you go, you feel uncomfortable. You feel you don't belong. You feel your very security, your even security of your body, security of the people you love, the security of even getting a piece of bread and being able to actually eat it in peace and in security. All of these things do not exist. You always experience a sense of displacement that is magnified because you have a transnational life. The minute I know that I was able to get an American passport, I immediately went and got it. And people here get a passport only for them to travel. And for us, it's the most precious piece of possession that you could always have, because it's the only thing that actually enables you the freedom of mobility that a lot of people take for granted who are not displaced. And if you're displaced, you begin to realize certain things. And sort of displaced people, they begin talking about things, and there is this repertoire of these issues that everybody has, like these traumatic experiences that they can share with each other. And they're not exactly the same, but there is similarities in between. What does it mean to go home? How hard it is? How is it easy to get a visa? Is it easy to travel? What does it mean if your loved ones die? Do you make it for the funeral or not? When you are living in a different place, and if it's compounded by curfews, by occupation, by problematic border crossings and so on, imagine how hard, how difficult, how traumatized, how every single step is an effort in your life.
Rabab, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Sabrina.
We've been speaking with Rabab Abdulhadi. She is professor of sociology and gender and sexuality at New York University. We spoke to her from New York. I am speaking with Haney Khalil, who is an urban planner and organizer for the group Racial Justice 911, People of Color Against the War. In addition, he writes for and is part of the distribution committee for War Times, The First Casualty of War is Truth. Welcome to our show, Haney.
Thank you very much.
What kind of paper is War Times?
War Times is a paper that was developed in February of this year. Basically, we begin from the premise that the terrorist attacks of September 11th began a very new and frightening period in our history here in the United States as well as overseas. Thousands of people died. Families lost their lives. People are still struggling to recover a year later. Many of the workers who lost their jobs, etc., are still looking for work. But the reality is President Bush's response to September 11th, his so-called permanent war against terrorism at home and abroad, is not the appropriate response. And in fact, all it has done is it further endangered the lives and liberties of millions of people here in the United States as well as abroad. And so recognizing that, we felt that it was absolutely necessary to put out an alternative perspective, give people access across the country to an alternative perspective as to what is going on, as to what the Bush war policies are really all about, and to bring to light the violations of civil liberties, et cetera, that are being carried out in the name of defending people here in the United States from terrorism. And so we're trying to support the growing peace and justice movement by developing information, compiling it, putting out analysis, and distributing it across the country. The paper is a bilingual tabloid, and it's actually being distributed in all 50 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico.
You are also the organizer for another group, which is the Racial Justice 911, People of Color Against the War. What do you consider to be the most pressing issues for people of color?
What's happened since September 11th is that George Bush and the ultra-conservatives around him have rammed through a series of reactionary laws that have further escalated the attacks on people of color that have been going on for many, many years here in the United States, building upon the stripping of rights of people of color, restricting affirmative action in California, for instance, increasing the number of jails that are now housing large numbers of African Americans, Latinos, and East Asians, for instance. And so what has happened is the war on terrorism now has become an excuse by which, in the name of pursuing terrorists on the home front, the Bush administration has passed legislation that has severely restricted the rights, particularly of immigrants, non-citizens.
Many of them have valid passports and are still being deported.
Absolutely. And the Bush administration has also passed a series of laws under the Patriot Act, so-called Patriot Act, which really have constitute the most severe restrictions on our civil liberties here in the United States since the McCarthy period, actually, in the 1950s, so that now the government has the ability to watch our to surveil email communications, to surveil what websites we go to on the internet, to actually enter our homes without a warrant at this point, when without giving knowledge to the person in the home. I mean, these are very severe restrictions.
How did you become involved with these groups?
First of all, because I'm a person who's been long active in peace and justice issues here in the United States, from fighting for workers' rights to fighting for peace in Central America in the 1980s and so on. So it was natural that I felt that I had to step up to the plate when the time was necessary to try to get active and head off this very dangerous war program here and abroad. Second thing is I'm an Arab American. I'm an Egyptian American. And people in Egypt and in the Arab world have been dealing with the problem of the Islamists, those called the fundamentalist Muslims, for many, many years. And we know that the answer to or the way to respond to terrorist attacks has nothing to do with going to war. You can't solve or weaken those forces by killing thousands upon thousands of innocent civilians. That is not a solution. What we realize is that you can only defeat those forces through political means. And that really means being able to look critically at U.S. foreign policies that have hurt so many people throughout the Arab world, the fact that the United States government has maintained sanctions against the Iraqi people for the last 10 years, supposedly to try to weaken Saddam Hussein. But the reality is, according to UNICEF in a 1998 study, that those sanctions are responsible for killing about 5,000 children under the age of 5 every month. We're talking about a million people that have been killed by policies that the U.S. government has pushed through the United Nations over the last 10 years. People here in the United States don't know about that. And those are the kinds of policies that have given the Islamist groups in the Arab world the ability to recruit supporters. If you don't want those forces to grow, if you don't want those forces to attack again, you have to change the policies that have caused so much violence across the Arab world and that these groups use to recruit supporters. That's why I'm involved in doing this.
And what would you say our biggest challenge is from this point forward with everything that has transpired over the last year?
Our biggest challenge at this point is to head off the coming invasion and war of Iraq. We find ourselves in a very bizarre situation where, at this point, George Bush is planning on invading Iraq. He's been declaring his desire to do that for more than 8 months. And yet he finds that some of his closest people, people that should be with him within the Republican Party, high-level military officials, et cetera, have actually come out against the war. So we've had Brent Scowcroft, who used to advise his father, Bush Sr., saying things like, there's a virtual consensus in the world against attack Iraq. It could lead to an explosion against us, et cetera. And yet we have more and more people here in the United States thinking hard, asking hard questions about whether or not war is a good idea, recognizing that you can't just go around attacking a country preemptively, that that's a major violation of international law, that defeating or removing Iraq, Saddam Hussein from Iraq, has nothing to do with making people here in the United States safer. There's been no proof whatsoever that Saddam Hussein is linked to the attacks of September 11th or that he's involved in producing weapons of mass destruction. There are millions of people here in the United States that are beginning to ask those questions. What we need are people to take a stand on this. What we need are people to stop being afraid of being called a terrorist by the U.S. government if they dare to speak out against this. There are people, millions of people whose lives are on the line. In Iraq, as well as here in the United States, those members of the armed forces who will also lose their lives in any kind of war and attack on Iraq. These are the kinds of things that have to be challenged, and it's imperative that people here in the United States, the only people who can stop this war at this point are people here in the United States. Our European allies are speaking out against this. There is no support for a war against Iraq in the Arab world. There's no country. I mean, Kuwait, the country that supposedly should be most afraid of Saddam Hussein, is not backing a war, nor is Saudi Arabia. So why is the U.S. government going to begin an attack on Iraq that doesn't have any kind of support internationally and less and less support here at home? What we need are people to get out, to organize, to be in the streets, raising their voices, saying this war is wrong, and you cannot use September 11th to justify these kinds of attacks.
Haney, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome.
I've been speaking with Haney Khalil, organizer for Racial Justice 911, People of Color Against the War. He is also part of the committee for the newspaper War Times, www.war-times.org. We reached him in New York.
What a wonderful country. But the man, he's burning down.
This is Sabrina Artel. Talk Universe, Seeking Justice has been produced in the studios of WJFF Radio Catskill by Southpaw Productions. Sabrina Artel, Dharma Daly, and Kevin Greff. Music, The Four Non-Blondes.